everybody, and welcome back to the Damage Report. I'm John Adirola. Big ol' show planned for you in just a little bit. Ryan Grimm is going to be joining us on the show once again to break down some of the big news of the day, especially the continuing fallout from the Iowa caucus debacle, which becomes more debacle-y with every passing day. They might be doing a full re-canvas. What exactly does that mean? Maybe we'll find out, I don't know. But it looks like a mess there. So we're gonna be talking about that and more. He's been spending time talking with different voters who are considering one candidate but have in the past supported others. I wanna learn a little bit about how people are shifting in which candidate they support in this primary. It's gonna be very important as more and more people drop out over the next few weeks. We've also got a deep dive into campaign finance, some of the differential strategies of Democratic primary contenders. And we'll be closing out the hour with Meanwhile In, news from El Salvador, the UK, and Antarctica that you're not gonna wanna miss. But before we get to all that, let's talk a little bit about what happened in DC yesterday. Prepare yourself, I'm gonna say some nice things about Mitt Romney. I don't love him, he's not my favorite person, let's not go crazy, but I have a fairly simple strategy where when someone does something bad, I acknowledge it. And when they do something good, I acknowledge it. It's taken me this far, so we're just gonna continue it. So there was the vote on the various articles of impeachment, and almost every single Republican did what almost every single Republican is gonna do, which is they are going to defer to Donald Trump. Any other, you know, political ideology, values, anything like that, that is trumped by their loyalty to the man, Donald Trump. But not everyone, and that was the biggest shock of this entire process, potentially, was that Mitt Romney actually voted on the abuse of power impeachment article. He voted with the Democrats on that. It still failed. Donald Trump is gonna be perfectly fine, but he did do that. And I want to acknowledge some of what he said in choosing to go that way. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
The grave question the Constitution tasks senators to answer is whether the president committed an act so extreme and egregious that it rises to the level of a high crime and misdemeanor. Yes, he did. The president asked a foreign government to investigate his political rival. The president withheld vital military funds from that government to press it to do so. The president delayed funds for an American ally at war with Russian invaders. The president's purpose was personal and political. Accordingly, the president is guilty of an appalling abuse of public trust. What he did was not perfect. No, it was a flagrant assault on our electoral rights, our national security, and our fundamental values. Corrupting an election to keep oneself in office is perhaps the most abusive and destructive violation of one's oath of office that I can imagine.
So that is amazing, mainly in how it's simply true. We all accept it, not everybody, but a lot of people, and not all of them are Democrats. I mean, we've shown you over the past couple of weeks the statements from a variety of Republican senators who voted against all these charges, who said, yeah, no, we accept what the Democrats are saying. He totally did it, he tried to pressure Ukraine, he was trying to influence election. We're not gonna do anything about it. Something, something, election, something, something, overturning the will. We're not gonna do it, basically. And Mitt Romney stands out simply as a person who is going to acknowledge that it's wrong and then say that that should matter. Again, it doesn't mean he's part of the resistance. It doesn't mean he's a Democrat. It doesn't mean any of that stuff. Honestly, like if you're gonna go through your life listening to people who try to find any little spark of hope or someone being reasonable or doing the right thing, and then attempt to make you feel bad for acknowledging that, that is a great way to be burned out of the entire system, to fall into apathy. Don't do that. Mitt Romney is not the greatest guy. He's voted with Donald Trump 80% of the time. He said lots of nice things about Mitt Romney. He's gonna go back to voting with Donald Trump a whole bunch of the time. We can acknowledge that and still acknowledge that he voted the right way, even though there are going to be some consequences to him for that. I will briefly note, I think it's weird that he voted in favor of the abuse of power charge, but not the obstruction of Congress charge, mainly because, I mean, in for a pound, or in for a penny, shouldn't you be in for a pound? But also, like the abuse of power is always going to be a little bit open to interpretation. It is not open to interpretation that he obstructed Congress, and I would say justice as well. He didn't cooperate in any way with the House investigation. That is a demonstrable fact. It's an enthusiastic thing that Trump has said. But he didn't vote for that one. Whatever, fine. He did vote for the one. Now look, I know there's gonna be a lot of dissection of exactly why he did that. We're gonna do a little bit of that in a moment. But I wanna show you some of why he says at least he came to this decision. It's a little bit of a long video, but I think it's worth watching. So buckle up.
The allegations made in the articles of impeachment are very serious. As a senator juror, I swore an oath before God to exercise impartial justice. I am profoundly religious. My faith is at the heart of who I am. I take an oath before God as enormously consequential. I knew from the outset that being tasked with judging the president, the leader of my own party, would be the most difficult decision I have ever faced. I was not wrong. Were I to ignore the evidence that has been presented and disregard what I believe my oath and the Constitution demands of me for the sake of a partisan end, it would, I fear, expose my character to history's rebuke and the censure of my own conscience. I'm aware that there are people in my party and in my state who will strenuously disapprove of my decision. And in some quarters, I will be vehemently denounced. I'm sure to hear abuse from the president and his supporters. Does anyone seriously believe that I would consent to these consequences other than from an inescapable conviction that my oath before God demanded it of me? We are all footnotes at best in the annals of history, but in the most powerful nation on earth, the nation conceived in liberty and justice, that distinction is enough for any citizen.
So look, none of us are mind readers. None of us can say for sure why someone chooses to do something. And almost certainly, especially when it's a politician, it's going to be a mix of a variety of things. I'm sure, look, he acknowledges the attacks that he's going to face. We're gonna be showing you some of them in just a moment. I'm sure he is doing some calculation of how much this is going to hurt him, how it affects his future plans, which he definitely has. I will simply say that from where I'm sitting, I cannot understand how even the most self-interested, deranged politician could think that this is going to help him to become president, as a Republican at the very least. It's not impossible, and politicians have been able to convince themselves of a great many crazy things, but I just don't see it. And you remember months and months and months ago when AOC was like, we need to get people on the record. We need them to sign their name to either supporting or opposing Donald Trump. We've got that. The vast majority of them will go down in history on the wrong side of this issue. Is it not impossible that one of them actually thought seriously about what that would represent? That Mitt Romney, a guy who is already wealthy beyond imagination, he's already tried to become president, so he has to understand that it's not incredibly likely to happen, that he could be a little bit thoughtful about his legacy and wants to go down as having done the right thing, perhaps believing that someday his party will be different. Maybe not in a year, maybe not in four, but that someday they will look back and say that that was a dark period in their history and that, man, thank God we've moved beyond that. We are used to, over the course of literally decades, Republican politicians and Democratic politicians using their faith as a cudgel, as a shield. It's fake, basically. It has no actual connection to their values. Is it possible that maybe he is thinking seriously about it? I don't know. Look, I can't read his mind, and I know that the vast majority of people are going to hate me for even extending this much goodwill towards him, but I want people to do the right thing. And while I can't say necessarily entirely what made up his motivations for doing it, he did do the right thing here, and I believe that we can acknowledge that. We can also acknowledge that he is going to be attacked, and that's where we turn to now. The backlash against Mitt Romney mostly preceded his vote even, but it's certainly coming in fast now. Take a look at what Donald Trump posted. This is just the beginning of a video he posted about Mitt Romney following Mitt Romney's vote in favor of one of the articles of impeachment.
Slick, slippery, stealthy. Mitt Romney had us fooled.
Being in Donald Trump's magnificent hotel and having his endorsement is a delight.
Posing as a Republican, he tried to infiltrate Trump's administration as Secretary of State.
President-elect Trump is the very man who can lead us to that better future.
Now his cover's blown, exposed by news reports as a Democrat secret asset.
What are you talking about? A Democrat secret ass? You guys found out our plan. I've been having meetings for Mitt Romney for literally years and paid off. You know what? Because after all that plotting, all of that, those backroom deals, we got one more person to vote for articles of impeachment that got voted down. What are you talking about, you crazy person? Yes, has he said nice things about Trump and is now voting against him? Yeah. From a Republican's point of view, that makes them look bad. I personally think that politicians should be able to potentially change in the face of new evidence. But anyway, he is getting pilloried. Lou Dobbs said, Romney is going to be associated with Judas, Brutus, Benedict Arnold forever. Yeah, I would say that this is basically on the level of the betrayal of Jesus Christ. Mark Levin said, Romney votes against Constitution with his vote today to remove a sitting president. The media and the Democrats are quick to celebrate their only Republican vote. Well, but shouldn't we? Some outlets seem to have known in advance. Imagine that. Endless softball interviews will follow. Okay, so let's focus on that first sentence. Romney votes against Constitution with his vote today to remove a sitting president. It is part of the Constitution that they can be impeached and removed. If you ever do that, you will necessarily be removing a president, but following the Constitution. And I want you to just pause with that thought for a couple of years. They're gonna try to impeach and remove Bernie Sanders in a few years. We'll see if Mark Levin still believes that that's going against the Constitution when they do it. Let's see. Rush Limbaugh's guest host for the day suggested that Romney should be sold to Venezuela, Ukraine, Somalia, or Yemen. I don't even know what that means, but it is a favorable invocation of human trafficking. And Donald Trump Jr. said, Mitt Romney is forever bitter that he will never be POTUS. He was too weak to beat the Democrats then, so he's joining them now. Dude, your dad lost the popular, oh God. He's now officially a member of the resistance and should be expelled from the GOP. Look, that is potentially going to happen, actually. He's 100% not part of the resistance. He is a Trump supporter. 80% of his votes have been on Trump's side. But this is a fascist movement, and loyalty is more important than literally anything. And so it doesn't matter if Mitt Romney got him elected. If he ever casts a vote against him, get out of the party. You're the next Justin Amash. I want to turn briefly to one more video, though, because this involves Fox and Friends. They took issue not necessarily just with his vote, but the fact that he talked about his commitment to God as one of the pretexts for it.
Regarding Mitt Romney, you know, it was bipartisan in the vote for conviction by one. Mitt Romney the Washington Post has this headline, no senator ever voted to remove a president of his party from office until Mitt Romney. And Mitt Romney is now suddenly the Democrats' favorite Republican. Mm-hmm. And if you saw Louie Gohmert on our air last night, he was wearing a button that said, Mitt, quit.
Yeah, I watched that interview with Chris Wallace, and he said these are his convictions. His faith is very important to him. He felt like—
Please don't bring religion. I mean, now you're not bringing into it, but I'm saying for him to bring religion into this has nothing to do with religion. My faith makes me do this. Are you kidding? What about your faith in this case meld together? I mean, that is unbelievable for him to bring religion into this, his faith. We already know how he felt. He gave a speech at 12 noon when it was candidate Trump, how unworthy he is for the office. This was his opportunity to show it. To me, it has nothing to do with faith.
You know, in how much Republican values can change from day to day, it is, I guess, nice at least to see a consistent stance from Fox and Friends that politicians should leave their religion out of it. Out of politics, they shouldn't invoke it. He was very clear. You can say that he's wrong, or you can even say that he's lying. But when he says that I believe that an oath is an oath to God, and I took that oath, and thus I can't turn against it, I mean, that's what a religious person would say. I love the idea that this is the step too far. Not, you know, like deporting people because of your faith, or launching wars because of your faith. That's not too far. But wanting to be honest before God, that's too far, okay? let's keep this thing secular. That is funny. Anyway, these sorts of attacks are gonna continue probably for the rest of the time that Mitt Romney is a public figure. And so all the more reason that Mitt did do the right thing. Doesn't make him a great guy necessarily, but he was the only one that did the right thing. Okay, with that, we're gonna take a short break, but stick around.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
The Iowa caucus obviously was a massive, perhaps historic failure, and we might not be out of it, despite the fact that we supposedly have almost all of the results. Supposedly, a re-canvassing might actually happen. And joining us now to talk about the failures and what might come out of Iowa, we've got Washington Bureau Chief for The Intercept and TYT contributor Ryan Grimm. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be here.
Great to have you here. So I know you've actually been traveling around. You've been on planes with the candidates. You've talked to supporters of the candidates. Before we dive into the specific errors, I want to get your impression as a person who has covered multiple elections about how bad Iowa actually was.
Well, it was about as bad as it can get. So Iowa, for people who haven't seen it up close, is kind of an unfolding, rolling disaster in the making every single time, just because of the way they do it. And it's kind of radical democracy, and it's beautiful. And radical democracy is a rolling disaster. If you ever went to an Occupy Wall Street General Assembly, when you get a lot of people in a room together making collective decisions, it gets messy. So the way that the caucuses work is that there's not a lot of security. At the one I was at, there were three dudes who came from Wisconsin to support Yang, and they just kind of blended in with the other Yang supporters. And at the end of the caucus, you had these Biden people and Bernie people and Warren people all like pleading and begging these Yang supporters to come join them, to goose up their numbers a little bit. And I'm watching this and I'm thinking, guys, these dudes are from Wisconsin. Like they can't even vote. and they probably if they tried hard enough, they easily could end up being counted in the tabulation. I put up a video earlier of these 69 Sanders supporters being counted, and they just kind of go in a conga line: 1, 2, 3, 4. And then they were like, "Well, we thought we had 71, but 69 is still enough to crush everybody here. So let's settle on 69." So then the precinct chair will say, "Are there any objections to the number 69?" And the other campaigns are like, "It's fine with us." And the Bernie Sanders people say, "It's fine with us." Then they wound up with 76 in the second ballot. But in other words, they're not even sure that they have the accurate number. They're just kind of agreeing to agree on this number. So every individual caucus is kind of a mess.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, they throw an app. And I think, the app company deserves plenty of blame for the way that this went down. There was a bug in their app, and it wasn't designed in a way that was easy for precinct chairs to use. The real fault to me is with the state party that thought that an app was a good idea. Mm-hmm. There's just this impulse among people to technologize everything, when you could have just used off the shelf technologies like texting or phone calls, or Google spreadsheet.
That's how I feel about Slack.
Right.
We don't need it, basically. I want to add one thing to what you're saying. So obviously there's the sort of the inherent nature of caucuses, that there's some ambiguity and things like that. We also have all this reporting about data errors. So there's a New York Times analysis, more than 100 precincts reported results that were internally inconsistent. There was missing data, or that were not possible under the complex rules of the Iowa caucuses. In some cases, vote tallies don't add up. In others, precincts are shown allotting the wrong number of delegates to certain candidates. In at least a few cases, the Iowa Democratic Party's reported results do not match those reported by the precincts. So now we know Tom Perez is saying that there might be a re-canvass in Iowa. Right. What should be done considering the things you were talking about now, these data errors that are cropping up?
Well, so on the one hand, they clearly do need to triple check everything. Like not just the Times, but all across Twitter, people were pointing out identifiable errors, just saying like, look, this clearly is wrong. This doesn't make sense. And so, if you can find more than 100 identifiable errors, then you know that there's a lot more errors than that weren't immediately identifiable. This is a caucus that happened in public. People voted with their hands raised in front of other people. It's probably the most video recorded voting, statewide voting that they've ever done. There's going to be photos, evidence, paper trails from everywhere. Now, one problem they're going to have is with this is the first year they did these paper ballots where they had people fill out. A lot of people just left with them because they didn't understand what they were. Like they raised their hand. So if they try to connect things to these paper ballots, that's going to be a problem for them. But they definitely need to at least compare what they put up in their spreadsheet to the numbers that were written down in the precincts and they took pictures of them or whatever at the time. On the other hand, for Tom Perez to tweet that out just as Bernie Sanders is like taking the lead in Iowa shows either outright hostility towards Sanders or just a complete and utter lack of self-awareness or maybe some conscious and subconscious combination of the two. But it's just absurd and how the errors just were continuously going against Bernie Sanders rather than if it's totally random, you'd expect some errors to work in his favor and some errors to work against him. And at times The Times said it did find some errors that did go against him, which is at least comforting. But the public high profile errors were all going against him. Yeah. And for Tom Perez to just come out and as soon as Sanders takes the lead to say that just doesn't show that he has his finger on the pulse of how half of the Democratic primary or electorate or more is just losing complete faith in the party to run a fair process.
Yeah, and most of those people have long lost faith in Tom Perez individually. I want you to stick around. We're gonna take a break, but when we come back, I wanna talk a little bit about the implications of this going forward, how it might affect the race. We'll be back right after this. The first caucus in Iowa was obviously a mess. Nobody disagrees with that. But we might disagree about what is going to come next. There's very real fears that the winner, or even the person in second place, whether it ends up being Bernie Sanders or Pete Buttigieg, that some of the wind might have been taken out of their sails by the messed up process, which continues to today. And joining us now to discuss, Ryan Grimm, back on the show.
Good to be here.
So Ryan, I wanted you to see, I saw the 538 updated projections this morning. If we could flash that graphic, they believe that Bernie Sanders has now about a 49% chance of taking the entire thing. In second place, you have no one. And then Biden's in third at 17%. We also saw that the fundraising data today, that in January of this year, Bernie Sanders raised $25 million, which is more than any candidate raised in a quarter, any other candidate raised in a quarter last year. So if you're a Bernie Sanders supporter and you're worried that, man, they ruined Iowa for him, how worried do you think that we should be?
Well, if you look at those numbers, you shouldn't be terribly worried. If you're a Bernie Sanders supporter, you don't want to take your foot off the gas. You never want to take anything for granted ever. But no, like the in some ways, there could be some benefit for the way that it rolled out. If he's probably raising a ton of money from angry people who are watching this unfold. When they eventually do announce that he won, if they announce that he won, that'll be another boost. It could be crazy if it takes them so long to do their re-canvass that they announce the results on Tuesday, which is the same day where he's very likely to win New Hampshire. Now, Buttigieg got a bump out of this, but he was going to get a bump coming out of Iowa anyway because he legitimately outperformed expectations, and that's what the media care about. How did you do? Not how did you do, but how did you do relative to how they thought you would do?
Yeah.
And people thought that he was fading, and so here he comes. Whether he comes out the delegate winner or just barely losing the delegate count and losing the popular vote to Sanders, he beat Biden, he beat Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
And so he's going to get that bounce, but that bounce is going to be ultimately artificial in the sense that the country knows that he's kind of a dead man walking when it comes to Nevada, South Carolina, Super Tuesday, or anywhere where significant numbers of non-white people are voting. So the other thing that Sanders has going for him is the competition. It's not like he's up against a generic establishment candidate. You know, if Biden loses New Hampshire and then again in Nevada, that's brutal for him. Elizabeth Warren's path is narrowing to maybe just a contested convention. Buttigieg, like we said, doesn't have a path in states where there are non-white people. That leaves Michael Bloomberg, who is ultimately going to have to face real people. He can't just run television ads for 6 months. So when that starts to happen, that could be problematic for him because he's not the kind of person that connects with regular voters.
Yeah. So I want to ask you about the Buttigieg. That's what I've wondered why there isn't more conversation about the fact that all of this, his whole strategy appears to be a gamble on the first two states and then just let's see what happens after that.
Yeah.
Have you spoken with anyone on the Buttigieg team? Do they acknowledge the lack of an articulated plan going forward?
Yes and no. I mean, so that is their plan, and what they would say privately is that there isn't another path. When you have a candidate who had a close to 0% name ID a year ago, your only shot at the nomination is to win Iowa, win New Hampshire, pick up momentum and just drive all the way to the convention. There's no, he doesn't have the ability to raise the kind of money that he would need to kind of match Bloomberg on television in Super Tuesday states. He polls terribly with Hispanic and Black voters. So Nevada and South Carolina are pretty much off the table. So he's just trying to win the first two primaries and then create an aura of inevitability. And, given what the alternatives are, that's about the best he can do. And I think they consider themselves to be playing with house money at this point.
Yeah.
As a kind of practical matter of raw politics, they deserve credit for getting as far as they did, even if they did so cynically or whatever else. To take someone out of nowhere and win the Iowa caucuses or finish second in the Iowa caucuses is a significant just achievement. It's not clear that they really had any other path to the nomination. So, like I said, it's house money. So they're just gonna keep spending it, and whatever else they've raised his profile and you know, he's going to be with us the rest of our lives.
Yeah. I wish that we had a lot more time because I want to focus on some more candidates. Unfortunately, we don't, but we should definitely talk after New Hampshire, and especially if it's New Hampshire and the final results for Iowa. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens there. Ryan Grimm, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
You got it.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, lots more to get to. In this packed Democratic primary field, for all of the differences between the candidates, and there are many, one that has created the most sort of drama on the debate stage, but also might be the most important and substantive going forward, is their theory on money, how they've raised money for their campaigns and what they think should happen with campaign finance going forward. Joining us now to discuss this, we have staff writer for the American Prospect, Alex Salmon. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks so much for having me.
Glad to have you here. I very much enjoyed your write-up of sort of the different camps of in terms of campaign finance, how they're funding their campaigns for the Democratic field. And I want to delve into all that. But first, for people who might not be familiar, can you break down what are the different groupings, basically?
Absolutely. So there's basically three different schools of thought on this and three separate camps. The first, and I think probably the most headline grabbing, has been what Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have done with their small dollar fundraising. And obviously they've posted some huge fundraising totals. Sanders in particular has broken records basically every quarter and every month at this point with his fundraising totals. And Warren has been close behind. And the two of them are both kind of running these campaigns entirely on small dollar donations, which is something that really hasn't been done at the presidential level. It's a serious leap of faith. And so far it's been very successful. And then kind of on the far end of the other spectrum, or the far other end of the spectrum rather, is the self-funded billionaires. And so we have obviously Tom Steyer and Michael Bloomberg, who are basically, because of their endless financial might, enacting essentially an end run around the democratic process and spending incomprehensible amount of money to put together a campaign with very little input from you know, people, donors, and democratic sources. And then the kind of leftover group in the middle, which used to be the what everyone did, the most traditional bunch, is the kind of traditional fundraisers. And that's Joe Biden, that's Pete Buttigieg, and that's a lot of candidates who've dropped out, Cory Booker, Julian Castro, Amy Klobuchar, obviously still in. And they kind of have some small dollar donations, but the majority of their funding comes from high dollar events, access events. They have bundlers who raise big sums for them, and they rely on super PACs.
And in your article, you talk about why that group has been particularly weak. Why is that in this particular cycle?
It's an interesting trend that's developed, and it's something we haven't seen before. But I think in part because of the billionaire class, which used to be content to sit on the sidelines and kind of pay for their politicians, pay for their access. In this cycle, they've decided that they actually need to be active in the process and run themselves. And so obviously Bloomberg is the best example of that. And with so many of those candidates competing for big money from, you know, Wall Street, from fossil fuel industry, from you name it, there actually hasn't been that much money to go around. And at the end of the day, despite this kind of enthusiastic embrace of big money that we've seen from people like Pete Buttigieg or Joe Biden, who obviously has a super PAC, there actually hasn't been that much money for them, even despite their kind of enthusiastic embrace of big money. So that's where we've seen a lot of these dropouts, and it's an interesting development, something that we haven't seen before.
And so I want to update people in case they didn't see that it was revealed today that in January of this year, Bernie Sanders apparently raised $25 million, which is just a crazy sum. But at the same time, you have Tom Steyer, but even more so Michael Bloomberg, willing to spend, you know, the GDP of a small country every quarter. And so I'm curious, you talk in the article about how self-funders much of the time in the past have ended up losing not only a lot of money, but also their bids. Is there something about Mike Bloomberg or Tom Steyer that you think might break that pattern?
Well, we've never seen anything like Mike Bloomberg in the political process before. And that's the byproduct of the kind of incredible inequality, wealth inequality we currently have in this society. And there have obviously been rich self-funders, and it hasn't been a particularly effective mode of intervening in the political process, largely been a kind of a doomed vanity effort. But Bloomberg has, the financial might that Bloomberg brings to the table is almost unthinkable. His commitment to spend at least $1 billion to get this done. The average week for Bloomberg, he spends over $40 million on television ads. That's more than Bernie Sanders raises in a record-setting quarter. And so we're talking about a scale here that we haven't seen before. And I think it's no sure thing that Bloomberg will pull this off, but we have to take seriously what he's doing, because it's the money does, at the end of the day, the money does work to some degree. The question is, how much can it work? And Bloomberg is going to basically take that question to its logical end here. We'll see how far it goes.
I have to mention that. I think it's amazing that right now there's like an ongoing, both on cable news and social media, back and forth over whether it is fair to call Bloomberg an oligarch, when you can take like the record-breaking Q4 numbers of Bernie Sanders, and every week Bloomberg blows that out of the water in money that effectively he earns back in interest on his wealth, in that same time period. So you're not obligated to comment on that, but I do think it's noteworthy when we're talking about campaign finance. So
yeah, absolutely.
I guess what I'm curious about is, in terms of the desire for reform, and you talk at the end of your article about campaign finance reform, I'm interested in, depending on who ends up winning this thing, with the experiences we've seen of the traditional mode sort of falling to the wayside, new evidence of how strong small dollar funding can be, but also this new thing of mega billionaires running, what implications do you think that has for the desire for campaign finance reform coming out of this season?
Well, it seems to me that we have, with these kind of two countervailing forces pulling in opposite directions, it's clear that the current system is extremely broken. Far beyond our wildest imagination, I think, has it been broken by just how much money has kind of seeped into every pore of the process, and that's obviously a byproduct of Citizens United, which we're now into the second decade of, and that decision. And it's a byproduct of extreme inequality. I think that, the outcome makes a big difference here. So, if Bloomberg is able to pull this off and he somehow ends up becoming the nominee, and then he somehow ends up becoming president, I'm not sure where that gets you, because this is not a model that can be replicated at scale. There's not that many. There are some, but there are not that many billionaires. You can't have a Democratic Party that's going to be staffed at every level, in the House, the Senate, and the school board by these kinds of people. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure where that gets you. That to me seems to set an incredibly dangerous precedent, where if Bloomberg wins, I don't know. I'm not sure what comes next. If one of the
Jeff Bezos, presumably.
Right, exactly. And that's the other thing, is that Bloomberg is incomprehensibly wealthy. Bezos is twice as wealthy as he is. Mm-hmm. So what is this? If Bezos sets his sights on an office, on a piece of legislation, on anything, what's to say that he can't do whatever he wants in the political process?
So exactly,
I'm not sure where this gets us. I think people are right to be wary of this, and I think it will just add to the call for campaign finance reform. But I have a hard time believing that someone who essentially bought the office is then going to turn around and say, I'm going to shut down the system that allowed me to do this. I don't think Bloomberg is going to be a great champion of campaign finance reform, and I don't think we should wait on him as our best and final hope for that.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you there. Alex Salmon, thank you so much for joining us. Everybody watching this, there's a lot more information in the article, which is available at the American Prospect. You should definitely check it out. Alex, thank you again.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
We're going to take a short break here, but we come back, meanwhile in. And now it's time for news from around the world, and meanwhile in. Meanwhile, in El Salvador, we are apparently seeing what should have been the expected obvious outcome of our immigration policy over the past decade or so. We know that when people come here seeking our help, saying they're fleeing domestic violence, gang violence, political persecution, I'm inclined to say that they're probably not lying about that. And if we send them home, that can have negative ramifications. So I want to talk about those ramifications. Not for all countries, this data specifically for El Salvador coming from Human Rights Watch. They say that while Salvadorans have asylum recognition rates as high as 75% in other Central American nations and 36.5% in Mexico, the US recognized just 18.2% of Salvadorans as qualifying for asylum from 2014 to 2018. And that means that during that time, we then deported with Mexico 213,000 Salvadorans, a little bit more than half of that comes from the US. So that more than 80%, what ends up happening to them? Well, Human Rights Watch identified and investigated 138 cases of Salvadorans killed since 2013 after deportation from the US. Those came from press accounts, court filings, talking to family members, officials in the area. This is not an official tally. Their research suggests that the number of those killed is likely greater. And the damage done extends beyond those who can be reliably identified as having been killed. It's much harder to identify because they're almost never reported to the press or authorities, but they identified or investigated over 70 instances in which deportees were subjected to sexual violence, torture, and other harm, usually at the hands of the gangs or who went missing following their return. This is obviously what is going to happen when people come to you saying they're fleeing either assault, rape, murder, and then you send them back to that environment. We cannot be surprised by this, but hopefully we can in the future change our policies so that this doesn't continue to happen. Meanwhile, in the UK, at least when it comes to automobiles, they are taking the climate crisis pretty seriously. Britain is going to ban the sale of new gasoline and diesel cars by 2035, 5 years earlier than originally planned. And for the first time, hybrid vehicles will also be covered by the ban, which is interesting, I guess, but also kind of obvious. They use gasoline, so how are they not included in the ban in the first place? But for many people, this is still going to seem like an extreme step. I mean, 2035, that's like next year, isn't it? And it seems like to get rid of all new gasoline car sales is pretty big. But honestly, if you're gonna say that you're taking this seriously, if you actually believe that things are as bad and are gonna get as bad as it seems like they will, then you're gonna have to take bold stances. You're gonna have to make major changes. And one world leader does recognize this, but this is gonna be a real trip. So the quote is, "We have a responsibility to our planet to lead." And you know who said it? Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Yes, because in the UK, Boris Johnson is a reprehensible monster of a man. But he accepts climate change, at least for the most part. Like, they're monsters, they're so much more reasonable than our monsters. Now, there is some pushback. The accelerated timetable drew immediate pushback from automakers, which raised concerns about the lack of clarity on whether the government would continue to subsidize sales of electrical vehicles, the lack of charging infrastructure, and potential job losses. And yes, you cannot simply ban the cars and that's it. You have to subsidize their purchase. You have to help people switch over potentially not to electric cars, but to public transportation. You have to provide the charging infrastructure. The government needs to be an integral part of that, but it needs to happen. And this is the sort of step that might seem extreme initially, but I think more and more countries are gonna move in this direction. Meanwhile, bad news for that penguin in Antarctica. We're gonna focus, we know that there's a lot of issues in terms of climate change with Antarctica, a lot that could go wrong, that could be devastating for coastal cities around the world. Let's talk about one cavity that was discovered under Thwaites Glacier in West Antarctica. It's 6 miles long and 1,000 feet deep. It's supposed to be ice, but it's been lost, and that represents a loss of 14 billion tons of ice. This is one glacier in one area of West Antarctica. And to give you an idea of how significant its loss over time has been, meltwater from that one glacier accounts for 4% of the entire global sea level rise that we have seen as we've been recording that over the past few decades. But how significant it is in the future, if that one glacier was to be lost, and it's expected right now that that's gonna happen in 50 to 100 years, assuming things don't accelerate, that could raise global sea levels by 2 feet. Not if Antarctica melts, not if West Antarctica falls into the sea. If this one glacier does, that's 2 feet of rise everywhere in the world. That is the complete destruction of a number of coastal cities. That is hundreds of millions of people who will then need to flee. And I got news for you. If Thwaites Glacier goes under, a lot of other parts of Antarctica are as well. Absolutely devastating, and we definitely have to take it seriously, as at least in this case, the UK apparently is. Okay, everybody, thank you so much for watching. I just want to read one quick review. I love this review from Non-Gospel Truth, who said, I watch John's show, this is on iTunes, live whenever I can and listen to the podcast version when I'm on the move. I trust John because of his guilt-driven honesty. So many times you see him pause and either cringe or verbalize some minor shade of self-loathing before making a counterpoint to one of his own arguments or to the discussion in progress. You can actually see the quote, I have to say this or I'll be staring at the ceiling until 3 a.m. hating myself for not saying it, undulate through his very soul. It pairs well with popcorn. He strives for an actual conversation, does his best to thoroughly research everything and raise awareness on issues like climate and voting rights, and has a slew of interesting guests on. Thank you so much for that review, everybody. Those iTunes reviews are super helpful. With that, we'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.